Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Anybody who listens to this program for any length of time at some point gets to understand that I am a geek about Iwo Jima. Started reading about it when I was a kid and obviously saw the sands of Iwo Jima. And then when I was a kid, I think it was Victory at Sea or something like that, where you would see, the very few documentaries you ever saw about the battle. And then as I've gotten older, been exposed to more books, but it's always been a fascinating battle for me for a lot of different reasons, and I have a huge collection of images from the battle, and so I was elated both when the series Pacific was announced to be produced, and then Clint Eastwood movies, both of them, from the Japanese perspective and also from the Marine perspective. And then that kind of prompted me to go looking for, very few accounts that have been done by Japanese survivors of the battle, which have tended to be very private. But only in recent years have started coming out and started talking about their perspective of the battle. The shame they felt when they came home because they survived. The horror they went through and knowing that they couldn't talk about it. And so, because it wasn't culturally appropriate. And so there's an event coming up that we're going to talk about today. And so joining me is Larry Reynolds. And he's a former Marine officer, a pilot. And so, first of all, Larry, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for coming on and doing this.
Thanks for hosting me. I appreciate it.
All right. Before we can talk about the event, I explained this a few minutes ago, we have to talk about you so we can determine if we can believe you or not. So, Larry, where born and raised where?
I was born in Amarillo, Texas. Grew up in a town called Pasadena, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston, for those that aren't familiar.
Houston's kind of a sweaty place, I've heard.
Yeah, it sure is. That's why I'm still here in California.
I'll tell you what, in God's country, right, San Clemente, which is my favorite town, it's in California. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a kid? You're in Texas. That's not Marine country. I mean, there's, it's a big state. I'm sure there's Marines there, but kind of smack in the middle of the country. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a kid?
Well, I'm going to try and give you the short version of a long story. I went to Texas A&M.
Oh.
I was in the Corps of Cadets all 4 years. I was in an Air Force ROTC unit. I had the opportunity at the end of my sophomore year to agree to sign up for the commission process, go through some additional military courses and a couple of summer camps, and when I graduate, would have been commissioned a second lieutenant in the Air Force. I took all the tests and qualified to go to flight training through the Air Force. But back then, I was sort of young and stupid, and I thought, why do I want to go in the military? I'm just going to get out of college and go have a good life.
Right.
So I elected not to take a commission, not to take the extra courses. Ended up graduating from A&M in 1965. And about that time, Vietnam was heating up. I was out of college no more than about 3 months, and I get a draft notice from the U.S. Army.
Uh-oh.
So I went down, and I talked to an Air Force recruiter, and I said, hey, I just graduated from A&M. I was an Air Force ROTC guy. How about me signing up for the Air Force and going to your officer candidate program? So the response to that was, well, we'd love to take you, son, but right now we don't have an OCS program. We get all of our officers through college ROTC programs. he suggested that I go to the draft board and get a 30-day deferment, come back in another 30 days, and he said, I'm pretty sure we'll be able to get you signed up then. So I did that. I got the deferment. I came back 30 days later, hoping that he was going to sign me up, and then I was told, well, unfortunately, things aren't progressing as quickly as we thought. We still don't really have an OCS program in place yet. Go get yourself another 30-day deferment, and I'm pretty sure we'll be able to get you in. So I went to the draft board a second time and asked for a 30-day second deferment and was told, nope, you've got 10 days. You either got to sign up with somebody or you're going to be ours in the Army. So it happened to have, in that same federal building in downtown Houston, there was a Marine recruiting office there. I went over and talked to those guys, and they said, we would be happy to take you. And they were even so gracious that this was in the November time frame, and they said, we've got an OCS class starting in December, and we've got one in March. Which one would you like to go to?
Wow.
So I said, well, if I have a choice, I'll take the one in March so I can stay home for the holidays. And so the guy said, no problem. You got it. That's how I got into the Marines. And I was so happy at that time to just not have to go in the Army as a draftee that I didn't even know the Marine Corps had airplanes at that time. That's how stupid I was. So I signed up for OCS expecting to be a grunt. And while we were in OCS, they flew the entire class down to Cherry Point, North Carolina for a full day of getting insight into the Marine Air Wing. A lot of static display aircraft and all kinds of information about the Air Wing side of the Marine Corps. And when we got back from that day at Cherry Point, the platoon class leader that OCS platoon I was in said, anybody that wants to sign up for the Air Wing, come see me. I ended up doing that and ultimately got a chance to go to flight school after being commissioned. So anyway, that's a long story of how I got to the Marine Corps.
Let me tell you, it's one of the most interesting stories on a regular basis, how people find their way to the Marine Corps. And, it's Woody Williams, Medal of Honor recipient. You know, I like the uniform. What? Yeah, I used to see guys in my hometown. I like the uniform, and it got me to Iwo Jima. I thought that if I had that uniform, I could get a girl, and which is not, an atypical story. But it's always fascinating. Talk to me about how do you find your way to being a naval aviator? And how do you find, you ultimately fly the F-4. Talk to me about how does that happen?
Well, as I said, when I was in OCS and I took the test to see if I could qualify for flight training, the results I got back after taking that test was, well, you didn't do so good on it. You didn't do good enough to be a pilot, but you did do okay to be an NFO, Naval Flight Officer, which was the program they had in place at that time for backseat F-4 guys and A-6 bombardier navigators and, I guess, a couple of other jobs.
Right.
So I ended up going to Pensacola and going through Naval Flight Officer School and got my wings in that MOS, and I ended up getting a first tour out at Marine Corps Air Station El Toro here in California. And I got assigned to a photo reconnaissance squadron as a backseat RF-4 guy and began to go through the program to get my MOS in that position. And while I was at El Toro training, myself and a friend of mine who had the exact same experience I had, we decided, let's go take that written test again while we're at El Toro, and we retook it, and we qualified the second time to become pilots or to go to flight training as a pilot. However, the Marine Corps, in its typical wisdom, said, well, we've already trained you to be an NFO, and in order to get our money back on that deal, you're going to have to go spend a year in Vietnam, and then after Vietnam, we'll send you to flight school. So that happened to both myself and my good friend. So we got trained up to be RF4 backseat guys. We got a 13-month tour in Vietnam. And my next set of orders coming out of Vietnam was to go to flight training. And in this case, I actually got assigned to the Air Force to go through Air Force flight training, which was kind of unusual for most Marines. But I learned later, I didn't know it at the time, I learned later there was a period of time during the late 60s and early 70s that the Marines had probably as many students going through Air Force flight training as they had in the Pensacola Navy program.
Really? You're the first one I've ever met. I'd never heard that.
Now, there's quite a few, and I think because the reason for that was Vietnam was going pretty well then, and I guess the Navy was not giving the Marines as many seats as they wanted to get in the Naval Aviation Pipeline. So they were paying the Air Force to train Marine students to be aviators. And at the same time, they were paying the Army to train Marine students to be helicopter pilots going through Fort Rucker,
right.
I think in Alabama.
Yeah.
And that lasted for 2 to 3 years, I think. But anyway, I ended up getting through the Air Force program. Got my Air Force wings, and for any Marine that went through Air Force training, you had to follow that to go to a special squadron, one on the West Coast at Yuma, Marine Corps Air Station Yuma, and one on the East Coast at Cherry Point. You had to go through a special squadron of TA-4 aircraft to learn to get some of the flying training that you would have got through the Navy program, but the Air Force didn't do that. And that was such things as air combat maneuvering and air-to-ground ordnance delivery and carrier calls and a few things that the Air Force didn't give you in their flight training program. So wow. I had to go through that, went through that, and then they give you Navy wings of gold. And then at that point, I was sent to El Toro, and I got right back in the same aircraft I had flown as a backseater and became an aviator, frontseater, and did probably another 20 years of flying in that particular position.
And what year was that when you ultimately get your aviator wing?
It was in 1970, I think February of 70.
Did you get back to Vietnam as a pilot?
No. By the time I got my MOS and got trained up, we were pulling out of Vietnam by then. I mean, so I never got a second tour. I got just one 13-month tour. That was enough.
Talk to me about, a lot of people haven't heard of the RF-4. It was still in service when I was the executive officer of the Marine Detachment aboard the USS Ranger. And so explain to everybody what the RF-4 was and what your mission was in Vietnam.
Well, the RF-4 was a photo reconnaissance version of the Phantom. It was over a Mach 2 speed aircraft, although you didn't go flying around at that speed all the time or for very long because you run out of gas very quickly. But the mission of the RF-4 was to collect photo reconnaissance through optical cameras, through infrared camera type systems, and through actually a radar system that collected imagery by a radar. They call it a side looking radar.
Right.
The mission in Vietnam was pretty much day and night photography using primarily optical cameras and the infrared system. We didn't use the side-looking radar all that often because it didn't give as good a quality of photographs as the optical cameras or the infrared did. Anyway, we flew day and night. assigned targets. We didn't get to pick the targets. They always came in from higher headquarters assigning us targets in South Vietnam, North Vietnam. We didn't go too far north. We stayed sort of in the southern third part of North Vietnam, and from time to time over in the Laos area. So it was just, you know, continually flying day and night, different types of photo missions.
What kind of armament did you have on the aircraft? And did you ever get involved in anything? I'm curious. So, I mean, obviously you worked over North Vietnam. I have, it's been, you know, as I've met aviators, the experiences that they had over North Vietnam are pretty unbelievable. talk to us about flying those missions in North Vietnam.
Well, I actually was pretty lucky. I never had anything that was what I would call a serious incident. As I said, we only flew in the southern half. The southern third. We never got up to Haiphong or Hanoi in that area where it was more heavily defended.
Got it.
I never saw MiG aircraft the whole time I was there. We did get, you know, sent indications of SAM missiles tracking us, and every now and then one might launch. But what I wanted to say is that when I first got to Vietnam, there was a bombing halt in place, and nobody was flying over North Vietnam for probably the first 3 or 4 months that I was there. And then that bombing halt got lifted, and when we started flying up there, you originally asked what kind of armament we had. On the RF-4, we had none. We carried no missiles, no guns, no rockets, nothing. We just had internal cameras, which was good for speed, but we had a requirement that if we flew into North Vietnam, we were required to take a fighter escort with us, which usually consisted of two aircraft. And we would brief the mission with those guys, telling them basically where we were going, what we were doing, what the altitudes were going to be, and so forth. And then they would follow us as we launched out of Da Nang and headed north. And as we got to the point where we crossed inland from offshore to head to the target area, they would drop back to about a mile in trail and just keep an eye on us. And if they saw us taking any kind of fire from any place, whether it was any missiles or gunfire of any type, they were cleared to roll in on where the fire was coming from and go after those guys. And that didn't happen all that often, but that was the purpose of why they were there. And that was the only time we ever had to take fighter escorts, is if we flew into the North Vietnam area.
Got it. The wow. The I'll ask you one more question, and then we'll talk about the rest of your career, and then we'll talk about the Iwo Jima Memorial Service and Banquet that you're a part of putting on. What would you say? What do you say when people ask you about Vietnam? You know, is there something that you believe most people don't really get about Vietnam?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, because that's been 50 years now.
Right.
And what I remember is, you know, as a young lieutenant, I went over there as a first lieutenant. And having seen a lot of movies, particularly World War II era movies, and the story that movies seem to tell, I was kind of anxious to get there. I felt like, you know, we're the good guys, and this is going to be something I'm proud to be a part of and looking forward to kicking ass, so to speak. And in the movies, the good guys always win. But then after spending a year over there and coming back after 13 months and reflecting upon that year's time, the thing that crossed my mind was, not one thing seemed to have changed in the year that I was there. We U.S. forces didn't seem to have made any more progress or gained any more ground or gotten any better at defeating the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong than it was the first day I arrived. And it just seems like, you know, we spent a lot of time in that country and lost a lot of lives, and we didn't really gain much. And, you know, what's the reason for that? I don't know. It could be because the war was being run more from Washington, D.C. than it was from being run by the folks in charge. But that was sort of my thoughts.
Interesting. Did you watch the Ken Burns documentary about it?
I did. I did.
Got an opinion about that?
Well, I was not impressed with it.
All right.
I think it had a little bit of a slant to it, but
right.
I mean, it had some good parts, but I'm not sure it told the true story.
Right. Yeah, that is the thing I hear most often from Vietnam veterans is that, you know, there were parts that I thought were good, but I didn't think it reflected, you know, certainly what was my experience. And I understand that it's a kaleidoscope of viewpoints, but I think that they came at it with an agenda, and I think the agenda comes through. So it's interesting.
Right, right.
You say pretty much the same thing. Tell us about, give us the high points of the rest of your career. You wound up as a squadron commander, but tell us about the rest of your career.
Well, I did a few things. I had the opportunity to go to the Naval Postgraduate School at Monterey and get a master's degree in management. But as a payback for that opportunity, I had to do a 3-year tour at the Marine Corps Air Station in Tustin as the station comptroller, which is kind of a number cruncher type job. You're familiar with that as a Marine yourself.
Right, kind of.
But, you know, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about that business. And so I did 3 years at Tustin as the air station comptroller. But at the same time, while I was in that job, I got a chance to fly over at El Toro in the Marine Corps' T-39, which is like a little business jet.
Right.
And I got qualified to be an aircraft commander in that aircraft and had some fun flying. It's totally different than what the Phantom was all about. We did a lot of hauling of VIPs around and other kinds of logistical missions. And then I guess the other interesting job I had was after I gave up the squadron at El Toro, I got a chance to go to Los Angeles and be the Marine Corps liaison officer with the FAA.
Oh, wow.
Western Pacific Regional Office, which at the time was in Los Angeles. It has since relocated up to the Seattle area, I think. But that was a good gig for 3 years, and I learned a heck of a lot about the FAA and how they manage the airspace around the country and so forth. And I learned things I wish I would have known when I was the OPSO and the CO of a squadron. I could have helped keep guys out of trouble a little better.
There you go. There you go. So you get out of the Marine Corps at what rank?
Lieutenant Colonel.
And then you started a second career at Camp Pendleton. Tell everybody about that.
Well, about a year and a half after I retired, I ended up going back to work at Camp Pendleton as a civilian, working in a job for the base commander. I was on the base staff, and it was sort of a community relations, public relations type assignment. I represented the interest of Camp Pendleton and the Marine Corps in dealing with a lot of local communities, elected officials, different organizations that did business on base, a lot of the tenant organizations that were on Camp Pendleton that were not part of DOD, but they're just on-base tenants that are there for different purposes. And it was a good, interesting job. I did that for about 22 years. And then retired from that in 2015.
So tell me how you cross paths. Is it in that capacity that you cross paths with this event that you told me has been going on for quite some time at Camp Pendleton? And we were talking before he came on the air, and you know, I expressed when Larry told me about that. You know, I said, you know, you'd see this stuff after it happened. In the scout, right? And or in the San Diego Union Tribune, but you didn't know about it beforehand, so you didn't go, and it was pretty frustrating because, the island battles of World War II, the Chosen Reservoir, that's the pantheon of heroes for Marines, and to think that you could spend time in their company, like the Marines that fought at the Chosen Reservoir, everybody stands around in awe of those guys and those men and women who did that stuff. And so, right. So how did you first come in contact with this group?
Well, when I was working at Camp Pendleton in this civilian job, I was like you. I had never heard about this organization or even knew that they met every year on Camp Pendleton with a reunion event. And it was in 1998 when the committee that at the time was composed primarily of all EWO veterans, and that was the committee that organized and pretty much put on this annual event, the committee came to the base commander and wanted to get permission to build a small monument on Camp Pendleton, a monument to memorialize and remember the Iwo Jima veterans. They wanted to get permission from the base to build that monument and then use that as the centerpiece of each of their annual events. Well, the commanding general said he was supportive of that, but in order to make it happen, there were a few wickets they were going to have to work through. And he assigned me to sort of be his direct representative to work with that committee and help them coordinate through all the other base staff wickets that they had to work their project through to get final approval. And that took about a year's time to get all that put together and go through the process. And once the process was complete, we briefed the base commander, and he gave them final permission to go ahead and build their monument. That monument was actually finished in late November of 1998. It was dedicated in February of 1999 at that year's Iwo Jima commemorative event. And because I had helped them work through the process, I was invited for the first time, me and my wife were invited to attend their annual banquet in February of 1999. So that was the first one I had gone to, and I was really impressed. At that time, I think there must have been around 800 total attendees. Wow. And probably at least 120 to 140 Iwo veterans that were there with their families and so forth. So from that time forward, they continued to invite me, at least for the first couple of years, to come as a guest to attend their annual event. And then after that, I said, well, look, I don't want you guys to pay for this anymore. I'd like to buy my own ticket. And my wife and I have continued to attend every year since then, unless we've been out of town. So I've now, this year will mark about 20 or 21 years. And it was probably the year after I helped them get the monument constructed, they asked if I would join their committee to just sort of serve as the base liaison from that point forward, which I've agreed to do. And so I've been on that committee ever since.
You know, I'm jealous. What first of all, it's called Iwo Jima Memorial Service and Banquet, and it's going to the whole program runs from February 12th to February 16th at Camp Pendleton and in Oceanside, California. It is the 75th anniversary of the battle. For those of you who don't know, tell us about the program. And first of all, is it open to the public? Is it open to veterans? Who can attend, Larry?
It's open to anyone. It's open to the public. It's open to any veterans. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of great promotion or advertising. And we're now coming down to the crunch time. I think probably maybe the end of this week or might be early next week is sort of the deadline to get tickets. But it is open to the public or anyone that would like to attend. Last year, I was there, and we had about 430, maybe 435 total attendees. And out of that, only maybe 30 veterans, EWO veterans, were there. They have continued to dwindle, you know, year after year.
Right.
I don't know what we're going to have this year. The last I checked with the lady that coordinates the ticket sales, I think she had 17 or 18 veterans had signed up, but that was probably 10 days ago. And we always get a few last-minute sign-ups. But the program is actually a three-day program, and on the first day would be Thursday. It must be the 14th or whatever that Thursday is. I don't have a calendar in front of me. But the first day is a all-day tour of Camp Pendleton. The second day, Friday, consists of an all-day tour of Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego. And this year there will actually be a graduation exercise on that particular date. So those who take the tour will be able to see some Marines graduating from MCRD.
Thursday's the 13th, Friday the 14th. And just so, if you've never seen that, right, if you're listening to this, if you've never seen that, if you truly want to see something really emotional, something special, and part of what the melting pot of this country is, you're watching parents and families, some aren't that are not from this country, who haven't seen their kid in 13 weeks, and that whatever version of their kid left, right, that kid is fundamentally different human being. And you see the coolest things. If you don't shed a tear at that, I don't know that you're human, because it is, especially for families that aren't from the United States, and this is now their, you know, now this grandson is a United States Marine, you know, and you know, with everything that goes through that, and you're watching these families, you know, how emotional they get and how proud they are. It is one of the coolest things you will ever see, and it's a very moving, very inspirational to watch the whole thing as recruits get to see their families for the first time, and the metamorphosis that has always happened at recruit training. So that's well worth the price in and of itself.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the cost for anybody that wants to take either of those tours, it's $40 per person per tour. There will be buses scheduled to take the folks on both tours, and that's the only way you can take the tours. You have to be on the bus. The bus will be leaving from a hotel in Oceanside, and I can give you more details later, but that's the way the tours work. And then on the third day, Saturday, the 15th, is the actual sort of the end of the whole of three-day event, and that's the banquet and memorial service that takes place in the early afternoon and the evening on Camp Pendleton at the Pacific View Events Center. That starts at 4:30 p.m. with a 30-minute outdoor memorial service, and that service is all about remembering those Marines, sailors, and others who were on Iwo Jima who did not return. And then that's followed with a banquet that's inside the Pacific View Event Center, and a program that's all about just commemorating this being the 75th anniversary of that iconic Marine Corps battle. The cost for attendance of the banquet is also $40 per person.
So $40. Now, in looking at the program, it talks about, you know, memorabilia displays and things like that. That the banquet, the 1st Marine Division band being there, and you even get a decent meal too. What talk to us about some of the stuff that, for instance, for somebody like me and other Marines or people that, you know, have grown up reading a lot of history, this is obviously a unique and different experience. What kind of stuff are they going to see there?
Well, at the memorial service, they're actually going to be able to see probably six or seven vehicles of World War II era that will be staged in the vicinity of where the memorial service takes place. They'll be able to see some current Marine Corps artillery pieces. Well, I take that back. They're not going to be current. They're the 105 artillery pieces, which will be used to give a 21-gun salute. Although you may have some current artillery pieces, which are the 155 size. Hang on. Sorry about that. That was a phone ring. You'll be able to see some equipment, some military equipment at the memorial service. And then on the inside of the banquet hall, you'll be able to see a lot of collections from some folks, some people who show up for that event every year who are just collectors of World War II and in particular Iwo Jima type memorabilia. So it's pretty interesting stuff if you've never had the opportunity to view it.
Yeah, you know, if you haven't, I mean, first of all, getting to be around a 21-gun salute, right? If you've never seen one of those, that in and of itself is worth the price of admission.
It is.
It is. I mean, look, so it is the sound of freedom. Other people could say whatever they want, but the sound of freedom is guns and jet engines, right? And so that is worth the price of admission. And then, I always love, I mean, the different historical stuff that people, that collectors, you know, bring with them is a lot of times it's stuff that, you know, you've never, ever seen or maybe seen a picture of someplace. And it's so incredible, so unique. And so, I have to tell you that I can't tell you how excited I am that Lieutenant Colonel by the name of Kevin Norton, who listens to All Marine Radio, sent me an email and said, "Hey Mac, you need to check this out." And I can't tell you how excited I am to attend, Larry. So let's talk about that. If anybody wants to attend, how do they do that?
Well, first of all, as you may know, it's becoming more and more difficult to get aboard military installations these days because of the increased security set up that most of them have, including Camp Pendleton. So anyone who may have a military ID or a retired ID card will have no problem getting onto the base. But if you're a civilian or in any other capacity in which you do not have an ID card, I would recommend that you come, you arrive early if you want to attend this event, because you'll probably have to go through a more strenuous check-in process to get onto the base, and it may take, you know, 15-20 minutes to get through the pass and ID office. Now, if you sign up for the banquet ahead of time, we're going to be putting a list out to include all names of all scheduled attendees that will be at the front gate. And we're hoping that's going to help speed up the process. So if your name is on that list, you'll be able to get through a little quicker.
Okay. All right. So where can they, is there a website where they can find the information that I'm looking at, that I had emailed to me? Where do people find information, in particular the contact information, to go ahead and make this happen?
Well, you know, I'm sorry I don't have that information in front of me, but if you've got a website that was mailed to you, that's probably the appropriate place. I do have...
Well, I'll put it on my website, so if you just go to this post on All Marine Radio, you will see the PDF file there that you can download. And it's about one, two, three, four, five page, including the map and an application.
Registration form.
Yeah, the registration form. There's a in recognition and remembrance form. And so there's a whole bunch of forms with maps and hotel accommodations if you need those kind of things and schedules and stuff like that. So that'll be included in this post. All you got to do is click on that, and then I do believe under the registration stuff there is the phone numbers, Gail Chatfield's phone number, and you can give her a call and I think take care of all of this stuff.
Right, that is correct. She is the proper person.
Got it. All right, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this event that you want to make sure that people know?
Well, unfortunately, this is the 75th anniversary, and it's going to be the last one. So if you've not seen it or never had a chance or never thought about it or never known about it, like many folks, this is the last opportunity because – for one thing, we're losing a lot of the EWO veterans, and it had been determined at the end of last year's event that this year, the 75th anniversary, would be the last one hosted by Camp Pendleton. So hopefully, if you haven't seen it and you want to, this would be the year to do it.
Well, that doesn't, you know, again, when you just do the math in your head, right, if you do the math in your head, You know, if you were 18 on that island, 75 years later is what, 88? And 75 years later, if you were 18, is add 10, is 85, and 8 is 93 if you were 18 years old when you went ashore. And so I'm honestly, when you said there were 30 that showed up last year, I was amazed at that. I mean, because you know, some people are coming across, you know, a fair distance to go to this thing. But it's interesting. Tell me, and again, my guest is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Larry Reynolds. Larry, what's the most unique experience that you've had in relative to Iwo Jima veteran?
Well, I've had a chance to meet a lot of them at this event and just to hear their stories. And like most Marine combat veterans, first of all, they don't want to talk a lot about it. But to hear some of their stories, it's pretty amazing. And I guess maybe what might be really unique for me, I was at a Marine Corps birthday event this year in November. And the oldest Marine present at that event was 97 years old.
Wow.
He was a very interesting gentleman. And at the end of that event, I went up and introduced myself. And I said, hey, have you, and it had made mention of him having been on Iwo Jima when he was honored to be the oldest Marine present. Well, I went up and introduced myself and I said, hey, have you ever been to any of these Camp Pendleton Iwo Jima events? He said, no, I haven't. I said, well, have you ever even heard of them? He said, no, I never heard of them. Then I ended up asking, well, where do you live? He turns out he lives right here in San Clemente, about half a mile from where I am, from my house.
Wow.
So since then, we've gotten together a couple of times. I've taken him to breakfast. I've taken him down to Camp Pendleton to show him that monument that he never even knew existed. So it's been an opportunity to establish a relationship with him, and he's really just a fine gentleman. So I'd have to say maybe that's my unique experience is learning I have this neighbor a half a mile away who never knew about this particular event at Camp Pendleton.
Wow. Now, you know, I've had a chance to interview. He was a PFC when he went ashore, wound up being a squad leader until he was wounded. And, you know, just the stories they tell of that battle and just the intensity of the fighting, you know, the way they fought, the way replacements came in. And all the different, the both flag raisings and just, I mean, which have been, I think, for all Marines, right, the PAOs screwed it up for that long, for God's sakes? I mean, come on. Yeah. I mean, they're still unscrewing that stuff.
Just this past year.
Right. And those stories are fascinating, and how, you know, it's my belief, you know, that John Bradley knew he wasn't in that photo, because if you look at John Bradley's uniform, he wears his leggings. His uniform is very distinct on top of that mountain.
Right.
And you see pictures of him the day of the Iwo Jima unveiling in the 1950s, and a lot of them, he looks like he's not a happy guy, and you wonder if he, you know, just lived with that fear that, you know, I went on that bond tour because they told me I was in there, and now they're telling me I'm in this statue, but I mean, good God, has nobody looked at the picture? That isn't close to what my uniform looked like. And, you know, and but, you know, went home and lived his life and raised his family and never said a word. You know, The same true with Harold Schultz, right? He becomes a postman, and he's in the picture, and only one reference anybody ever has of at a dinner table when his wife, his stepdaughter, you know, is sitting there. His wife's on the phone, and he looks at his stepdaughter and says, "I'm in that picture." And that's the only reference ever that the guy makes. And then the newest guy, what's his name, Short?
Schultz, I think. Is it Schultz?
I can't remember. But, I mean, he went home and he didn't say anything to anybody.
Yeah.
Ever. And you wonder if they just didn't want, you know, they watched, you know, the hullabaloo that went on surrounding the guys who got named in it, and they just thought to themselves, I don't want any part of that, right?
Yeah.
And it just, to me, there's so many fascinating pieces. And again, you know, a lot of, you know, Marines still to this day go back there, and the island largely untouched other than the Japanese, you know, airstrip that's on there. And it's still somewhat, not somewhat, I mean, it's Valhalla for Marines. You go to Iwo Jima, right? And you know, you walk up that sand, and I mean, I have some sand from Iwo Jima that sits right next to the sand I was recently given from Quezon. And, you know, it's sacred marine stuff. So, again, I would encourage anybody, if you have and I didn't know before we came on, Larry, that this is going to be the last one, but if you have an opportunity to come be around these, I had an opportunity. I went to the funeral of one of the company commanders. Well, he's a company commander of Bravo Company 126 at Quezon. And I went to that funeral probably a year ago. And to be with those guys, to listen to them, right, their stories, and to meet them and see what good people they are, and then to understand the struggle that they had after they came home, and that they over the obstacles they overcame, it's just the best. It's the best and warmest feeling. And so I just want to encourage you, if you can get there, get your ass there, because it'll be something you will never forget, and you're going to meet some people that are, you know, are going to move your heart. So anyway, Larry, first of all, I appreciate you coming on today and doing this, and hopefully we're going to have somebody from a veteran from Iwo Jima come on with us next week, and we'll get that done and continue to, you know, publicize this thing in the hopes that a lot more people can come.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get the gentleman I mentioned. His name is Tony Kappa. I will try and get him here to do the interview with you one day next week.
Okay. Tony Kappa. What did he do? Who was he with? What did he do?
He was with 4th Marines. I think he was infantry, but he was with 4th Marines when he went aboard Iwo Jima, and I think he was one of the older guys. He was like 23.
Well, yeah, no kidding. Yeah, no, that part of the story is amazing. How young the 4th Division and the 5th Division, you know, actually had older guys in it. Was it the first time his first fight, or had he fought previously in the Pacific?
I'm thinking he was at Guam. He was somewhere else, I think, before Iwo.
Right.
It may not have been Guam. It was another island, I think, that they went to before he went to Iwo.
Right. And it was interesting because the 4th and the 5th Divisions were, you know, about 40% guys who had fought. you know, they knew both those divisions would be, and those veterans would be necessary to help with the fights on Iwo Jima and then on Okinawa. All right, sir. First of all, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you doing this, and good on you for your involvement in this.
Thank you, sir.
No, it's I don't think there's any labor of love quite like helping other Marines, and especially this unique group that has such a special place in Marine Corps history. So, well done, and I look forward to next week, Larry. Thank you.
Okay, and I look forward to seeing you at the event as well.
No, trust me, with bells on. Okay, you'll know though. That must be McNamara. He's got bells on. So anyway, thank you for doing this.
Yes, sir. All right.
Have a good day. Thank you. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.